Welcome to Open School of Business. Today I have a pleasure of introducing you to Dan. He's from Canada and he's the CEO of this amazing company for maintenance. And Dan is going to tell us more about it. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure. I'm excited to talk about maintenance care and how all of this came to be.
Awesome. Can you start off maybe about what you've been doing before you started your own company and how it led you to finally start your own business?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I went to film school when I was younger, and I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I actually always ran my own companies, even out of school. I had a wedding video production company that I would do wedding videos, and so that got old pretty fast with dealing with people getting married. It was a challenge, but it was always something that I wanted to do. I then had an advertising company that I started. Everything was very small, but it was still experience and kind of how to build stuff. And so that was always part of my desire, is to grow companies. And then previously I actually did still work at traditional offices, and I worked for an insurance company doing marketing, and it led to meeting some key people that one is a developer that I became friends with, and we kind of created the idea of a maintenance software as a product, and then formed our own company from there. So it was the office experience was really valuable for me, in that I learned how to properly run a business, and how decisions are made for different reasons all the time, and it's not always what you think it is. And so that was good experience for me, and it kind of comes full circle now that I'm managing a team and people that have careers and want to head places, and that's important to know as well. So all of that came together, and for the last 20 years now, we've been doing maintenance care, and it's been successful, and we're excited to keep it growing. So
I love that you've gone through different trials and different industries, because sometimes people think like, oh, I don't have this one great profession that I can start and be expert in. But you don't really have to be, because as long as you keep trying and you find something that works, you can make it work. So this is a great example. How did you deal with this maintenance industry? Because you were new to it, right? Was the other guy an expert of that field?
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say none of us knew anything about maintenance when we were more excited about the software part of it. We had a software we wanted to build, but the maintenance side wasn't something we were familiar. That was our target audience. It's our products, functionality was all centered around it. And it, the reality is it took us quite a, many years for us to understand really what the maintenance teams were doing on a daily basis. So there were some negatives to it, obviously, because we came in and we designed what we thought would work, and it didn't necessarily always work on the ground, where they're working every day. But what it did, we were open-minded to hear feedback from our customers, and we kept editing the software until it became what they needed. And so it took some time, but as long as you're eager to learn, you can learn an industry. You hear it from your customers, and they're more eager. They have a need for a software, so they'll tell you exactly what they need, and that's really valuable information that you can build on. I'm still not an expert in the field of maintenance, in the sense that I could go down and do what they do and fix boilers and track HVAC readings and so on. But yeah. I'm familiar with their workflow and their day to day, and we've really integrated into their process to understand what works and what doesn't work. So. I think that's mainly the advice I would say, is it when it starts to fit and work, when the response from the customer is positive. And that's how we knew we were building in the right direction.
Yeah, that is amazing. How did you stumble upon this industry? Because I think it's such a hidden industry. You wouldn't think about it. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, so it actually started, we had a funny story with the introduction of this was that there was a toilet in our bathroom that was plugged at the office. And so we had to tell somebody about the plugged toilet, and we had to go to the receptionist and had to say, okay, what, you know, where do we tell this? And then the receptionist said, you just put a sticker on the maintenance person's door and they'll respond. We're like, okay, this is kind of weird. Like, there's no technology. Now, this was 2002. So, you know, mm-hmm. the internet was kind of starting, and there wasn't a lot of, you know, computers were in the business world, but not, you know, not necessarily a given for maintenance, right? So so we thought, let's just create something that communicates to the maintenance person. And at the time they had like pagers, two-way pagers. So our software was communicating with the pagers, and it was letting them know that they had an issue, and then they can respond by the pager and so on. But where we were wrong is we thought we would be in condos and apartments and things like that. And really the need was in senior care initially. And senior care, because they had so much compliance from the government to say, you need to do things in certain ways. And we didn't realize that they actually needed a tool to report on more than just the communication, but they need to show that they're doing the work properly, you know, for inspections and things. And so that once we saw that the senior care marketplace needed something, we then focused in that industry, and that's when we really started growing. So that's been the path.
That's very smart. Yes. So when that toilet plug happened, what business you were working on? In the office.
So that was when I was on the office at an insurance company, and I was in marketing, I had two friends that worked. One was in marketing with me, and the other one was a developer in the tech area of the insurance company. And that's when we kind of started talking and formulating the idea of this to build the software. So,
Yes. I mean, it's a classic example of where you kind of solve your own problem.
Yeah.
You're trying to communicate with your own maintenance person.
That's it. Exactly.
Yeah. That is great. Yeah. So, you know, that covers about, you know, how you identify your target market, because you went into an industry of senior care because they had the compliance things that were specifically more advanced than any other place. So that was genius as well, I think, because when the pain point is bigger, when they actually have to do it, it's definitely becomes a thing where they wouldn't think about not buying the software. So that is very great.
Yeah. And, you know, I would add that, like, if you have, you know, you have any ideas on a product and you think, okay, this is going to actually solve a need where they're going to be able to schedule their people better or whatever it is, the software that you're building. If you can find those peripheral motivations with other, you know, whether it's a government body that inspects or whether it's a you need to report to the, you know, for tax purposes here with your software, would add that extra value. That's where you're really going to get that, you know, that people are going to be motivated to get something because to find a solution, like you said. So I think that's that extra layer makes a difference.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. Compliance is always very pressing.
Yes.
And is number one. So how did you finance your company in the early days?
Yeah, absolutely. So we made a choice that we didn't want. Our goal when we started the business, and, you know, right from the beginning, why I wanted always to start businesses was the independence. I really seeked the concept of having a decision making being on our team, that we would make decisions and they would directly impact our benefits. So what we did was we decided, let's not get funding. We're gonna pay for it ourselves. Initially, we were lucky to have the developer as part of one of the owners, so that didn't cost a lot of money. He was able to do that, and then. As we started to do marketing, we had to remortgage we had built a bit of equity in our mortgages in our house. We remortgaged our houses and kind of grew a little bit, got some customers, paid down the mortgage a bit, remortgaged again. I think we did that three times. And it was every single time we made those choices to risk our own money instead of getting an investor from outside that would have a decision-making ability over the product's direction. And so that grew us to a point where we finally tipped that scale where the organic growth of the business sustained the ability for us to hire employees, do proper marketing, and stabilize our operation. And now we don't have to mortgage our houses to do it. We have the income of the business. But so where that benefit is, it's definitely the fact that you make your own decisions, definitely the fact that you can direct the product direction for your customers as opposed to just for somebody who's got invested money in there and deciding, okay, you know what, this is what I want my money back, so you better do this. The downside is it takes you a lot longer and you're risking a lot more for yourself. And it's not that always easy of a decision. You know, when we're going through this, we don't know if we're going to be successful. It is difficult for us to make those decisions to say, do we really want to be homeless, like lose our house and have to start all over. I was making, decent money at an insurance company. I would build equity. So we risked all of that. It's not an easy decision, but ultimately, we're happy we were here. We're lucky and fortunate that we were successful, but it's not always, it's not always a recommendation for everybody. You have to know what you want to get into, right? Long term.
And you were lucky you figured out this senior care industry. Yes. Kind of right off the bat. But what did it take you? What were the factors in getting those customers? Because usually these organizations, they're so slow to, write the check, even sign any kind of paper. So how was that process? And can you describe it more in detail so we understand how to deal with customers like that?
Yeah, it's like the challenge of the fact that they are slow moving is also a good barrier to us sustaining the business in a way, because they're so slow at moving, they're also slow at moving out. So they stay customers for a long time. So that's an advantage. But at the same time, you're right. It took a long time. And where I think there's a couple of tipping points. The first one was, had good partnerships in the industry. So we partnered with other companies that they trusted and already did business with. And so we tried to build a name for ourselves by connecting ourselves with big names. So that was we worked hard at trying to get those relationships, those partnerships and relationships with these big companies. That was one of the things.
What kind of companies are they?
Yeah, so one of the companies was called Point Click Care, and they're an EMR solution. So basically what that is this is in senior care, whenever that a resident gets a pill or any type of medicine, they track that in the software. And so they were already in most senior care homes. And so it was, okay, well, now you're dealing with your nurses through this software, deal with your maintenance team through our software. And that was kind of a good segue into that. So that was an example of that type of scenario. But so that was one of the, kind of early on, just to who is this company? And, oh, okay, well, they're associated, that'll a bit help. But on its own, it wasn't enough, right? So one of the things that happened where we were fortunate, again, was the iPod Touch came out, right? So the iPod Touch, this little gadget with all these little apps on it, it was an exciting tool. And when that came out into the industry, we started giving those away. We were saying, if you sign up with us, you'll get a free iPod Touch. And that iPod Touch was such a fun gadget for the maintenance person. Their motivation was like, I want one of those, right? Like, I'm not going to get one otherwise. So yeah, let's sign up. I'm willing to try this because I get this free device. And that's when we really see things grow really fast. So again, it's just trying to use the tools of the excitement of things that people had around you, and tag along to that. And it kind of helped. Right. And obviously there was a need. Obviously we were able to build the software to fit that industry as best as possible, but those little things that, like partnerships and gadgets, they definitely helped.
You wouldn't think about it right off the bat. But did you interface with the maintenance people or the management? What was your first point of contact when you started the collaboration?
Typically the setup of a maintenance person is they're in the basement of the whatever building they're managing, and nobody knows what they're doing and nobody cares. And then only when there's a problem, you better get down here and fix it. And that's typically the relationship that has been existent. Now, in other countries, that's not the case. So what we found out is in some other countries, they're actually highly university level education. They're part of the executive teams. They make decisions that are very fundamental to the business because it's the environment that you work in. So that's important. But for some reason in North America, that's not the case, right? So so what we were initially doing is getting the buy-in of the finance team or the president or whoever was really aware of the fact that maybe they weren't very compliant and they would be the person that would actually be ultimately responsible. And then our job after that with the management and CEO, whoever of that location, we would try to convince the maintenance person that this was not going to be threatening to their job. It was actually going to help them. And so that was the challenge. And I always used to say we had two obstacles. One is to make them understand that they need a software like this. And the second obstacle, make them understand that we're the best solution for that software. Whereas now the market has changed in such a way that people know they need a software and we're actually just trying to convince them we're the right solution. So we skipped that first step. But that was really the scenario. We would start at the top and we would try to work our way to the maintenance person. Once we got the maintenance person's buy-in, which would eventually happen once they use the system, at first it was probably apprehension, then everything would flow. That's why they've stayed customers for such a long time, is because there's that buy-in and they're using it and it's bringing value. So
awesome. So when you started, do you know how many companies were there already doing what you've been doing?
Right. Yeah. So they back in the day in 2003 to 2006 area. So that time period, there was a couple of competitors in the marketplace and they were selling CDs to install on a computer. They were not selling software as a service, which is what we are. Software as a service being a monthly membership that you pay for the software and you can just access it through a browser. Whereas they were actually selling a CD. This is what everybody was doing it. Selling a CD, you install it on a computer and then you just manage it yourself. And the advantage of that is you buy it once, you don't have to pay for it ever again. But the disadvantage is that it's not always up to date with the new operating system and you have to back up your own data and it gets corrupted often and support is expensive and all these extra things. So what we were able to do when we came in, because it's a monthly membership and we are self-funded, we can keep it low as far as cost. We were able to displace those companies that were selling the CDs at a high cost. We were saying, instead of paying $20,000, pay us $100 a month. And that's it. And so our competition had to rewrite their entire code so that it became a web-based software. But I think by that time we had started to gobble up all the customers and it was hard for them to maintain that. I don't remember exactly what happened to them, but I think, you know, like most of these companies, what they do is they go out and get investors at that stage and then they morph into other companies. And I think that's what happened. So we're one of the only companies left in Canada that is owned independently, privately owned. And we now also have an office in the US in Davenport, Florida. And so we are, we're one of the only ones left, I would say, that does this privately held. And I think that is a true advantage for the customer if they do choose to go with us, because you're getting that personal service and it's not dealing with this other motivation, which is to make money for the investor. And so that's been our story related to that.
That's amazing. And I like that you mentioned that you grew and you have opened an office in Florida. Can you tell us more about how that decision came about? When did you do it? And what is your operations there?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a couple of factors that played into that. One is we from a Canadian based office, we were selling the software to the US marketplace eventually. And, you know, that was going fine. But what we were realizing, a couple of things is, you know, there were some scenarios, let's say even with the financial processing of their payments and things like that, where it was necessary for us to keep the payments and the dollars in the US for several reasons. And so that was one of the obstacles that we needed transactionally. We needed something in the US. There was also the fact that, as I would expect, Americans want to deal with American companies and paying taxes in the US and all of that stuff. So we decided that's the fair thing to do. Let's go and open an office. And we chose Florida for a couple of reasons. One, it was in the same time zone. And two is that it was a very good hub for senior care, which is a big part of our marketplace. So those two decisions, and it's warm. I guess that's the other part. But, you know, it's those were the other scenarios why we chose that as an office. And it's worked out really well. We, you know, it is extra cost for us as a company, of course, because we have two sets of accounting and so on. But, you know, in something that happened in 2018 is a new law that came out called the Wayfair Law. It was about Wayfair selling products in other states. Okay. And they weren't paying taxes because they weren't from that state, but they were selling in that state. And so, you know, states started to realize, listen, this is not fair. We need to charge you state tax, even though you're not in that state. So every state is different now, and they all charge different types of taxes. And it's a very complex scenario. It's called, you know, did you hit a nexus into that state and so on? And I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but the bottom line is being a US-based company really helped us create that infrastructure so that we can respond to those new laws and pay the taxes in the appropriate states and so on. So it's a lot easier to have a entity in the US to do those things.
All right. Yes. And you were able to open a business without being a resident, right? So that is
was a complex mm-hmm. thing. So as a Canadian, we had to get an E1 visa, which is a visa that allows us to work in the United States. And in doing so, we also had to promise a certain amount of revenue to the US. And so we did that and we achieved those goals. And we were confident we would because we had, you know, already built the business and kind of were growing it. So we were able to, so that E1 visa, it's not a permanent visa, but it's a visa that you work on that you, you know, you get to work there. And then once you have that, then you have to open the bank accounts and build the, you know, the corporate structure. That took years. It wasn't easy. It was a long process, but now we have a stable business there and it's recognized as such. And it really has a good support, which is the Canadian entity supports it. So that, you know, makes it even more stable. But, you know, both businesses are owned by us as privately held, owners. So it's not different owners. It's not other investors. It's still us that owns both of those businesses. So.
Right, right. I think it's an excellent idea to actually put the flag into wherever you're doing business, because then of course the credibility and you can grow more.
Yes.
And this taxes definitely makes it so much easier when you're dealing with just the entity that is local. So
yeah, and sure. There's another thing that people don't, that they miss, but you know, we started noticing that when we go, let's say we travel to California, let's say, okay, and we were talking about maintenance care in California, logging in to maintenance care right from California, all of a sudden we started getting customers from California that we never met with. And it was our Google search engine capabilities were increasing in the places we would visit. So the same happens when we're in Florida and we're managing maintenance care within Florida's office, our Google rankings go up for the region. It's part of the algorithm of Google. So it actually helps you to be in that physically into that place so that your SEO ranking increases for people to search you. And it actually works. It's a direct result to that. So that's another mm-hmm. benefit.
Yeah, great. And also as an entrepreneur, and you said, you know, privately held and things like that. So are there any tax or financial decisions that you have made that helped you to maintain more wealth, let's say? Because, you know, I know people don't like talking about it necessarily on air, especially, but there are so many legal things that people can do to acquire more wealth, basically leave more money that you earned in your own pocket instead of just giving this here, that there. It's yeah. just when you open a business, there's so many expenses, so many things to pay and taxes yes. and other expenses. It just gets crazy. And I wonder, how did you deal with them? And is there any significant advice or tip you have, like how to offset some of these things, how to deal with these things?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I'll tell you something we didn't do that we should have done when we started, which is to pay ourselves a salary and pay taxes on that salary, but owe it to ourselves as the years go on, because we didn't know if we were going to be successful. So that's one thing that if you are paying yourself paying the taxes on a lower salary at the beginning, your taxes are lower because you're earning less. And so you're paying those taxes. So if you can afford to do that part, paying the taxes, but maybe not paying yourself really, just owing that money. So then as you get that money into the company, you can take that money out and now it's owed to you and you've already paid taxes on it. So that would have been a legal way that if we would have had forethought to say, we're going to make it, then we're going to be able to pay ourselves eventually. Let's just sacrifice even more at the beginning. We just didn't know. And I don't even know that we could have afforded to pay ourselves to pay the taxes.
Yeah, because you have the upfront tax payment on yourself as an individual.
Right? Exactly. So that would have been one of the things we could have done that would have helped us. Now, my biggest advice, if you are earning a salary, obviously your salary is always related to your tax bracket, especially in Canada, is always related to your income that you earn. And so the biggest goal is to defer the income right now. So, you know, are we going to be doing this forever? Are we going to be earning a salary, let's say at a certain level forever? Maybe, hopefully, but maybe not. And so what you try to do is you defer the income. So you invest it, you put it into another company, you put it into, in Canada, we have RSPs and those are like your retirement funds and so on. And you get money back for investing in these long-term retirement plans. And then once you're older and your income, let's say, drops because you're no longer doing something that's at this high level, you can then collect that money back from your retirement and you'll be taxed at a lower amount in the future. And so that's the most traditional way of doing it, which is just deferring income. Another way is just to keep other businesses going. So what you do is you create other businesses and you make sure that your shares of your company are owned by, let's say, another business that is investing in other things. So you can, you're paying corporate tax on that income, but not personal tax, which is always higher. And now using that money to invest it in other companies and buying other companies and so on. So that, always just reinvesting, I guess, is the key. That really helps you in the long term, too, because you have a lot of breadth of potential.
Stuff.
Yeah, diversity. And but I think deferring income is the key. However you achieve that is probably the best thing. That's on a personal level. On a business level, there's other things you can do. But on a personal level, that was part of the goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think investing is just such an important step that everyone should take in their lives, whether you have a business or not. Yeah. And it's always interesting to see what people invest into, like people and the businesses. Like, for example, do you try to buy some kind of real estate or anything for your business or equipment? I don't know. How does that go?
So actually, we have to be careful about buying anything that they call a passive asset. Like we, because we're a software company and we have certain rules, if we have too many assets that are not active assets, like that are actually earning revenue, you get put into a different tax bracket for different reasons. There are some rules around that. But yes, if you, I think real estate is, for me, has always been the most steady process. It does go up and down, but unlike, let's say, stocks, where you're really risking a lot of things, real estate is a good way, especially if it's income earning real estate, like an apartment building or something like that. Then, maybe you're not going to make, huge amount of money, not 10% on your money or, and so on, but you're going to able to park it there for a longer time and then eventually use that equity that you've built to grow other things. So it's more of a long-term plan, we'll say about 10 years, maybe 15 years in real estate, and you are starting to gain some things, unless you have other methods within the real estate process of gaining some quick money. I think that you should be looking at it more long-term for those types of things.
Right. So in terms of the longer term vision in general, what are your longer term goals for the business and for yourself? When do you see sort of a transition into something else, then what would it be if you
started? Well, so we've started that already. We've created three other products. We have a product called Care Clean, which is a housekeeping software that's like maintenance care, but for housekeeping. And then we have, another product called One Access, which is a visitor management and room booking software. So we've got all these different tools that we're starting to build and trying to, it's still building and facility oriented. Some of our customers are dual customers and buy more than one product, but ultimately it's just trying to build different aspects to our business. So that's one thing that we've already started to transition. I do think eventually, maybe in even some of those products, we eventually will get funding. Let's say for One Access, we decide, okay, we want to get funding for that and just for that product and just see how that goes and how that relationship builds. There's a possibility of that just to gain some experience in other methods of growing a business. So I think that that's definitely a potential for us. And then we'll see where that takes us. I mean, the future with AI and everything is exciting. So, I mean, there's lots to build there. And so we're excited to see how it goes.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
That's another question. Do you incorporate AI in some of these new things?
Yeah.
Are you looking into them?
We actually have. In the last year, we had a team that's dedicated towards it. And what they're doing, so we're starting actually in maintenance care. We're aggregating all the data that we've collected from every customer throughout all the years, millions and millions and millions of pieces of information that we can have AI learn from and then provide advice to our customers on demand. They can ask, and this is not built yet, it's getting there, but they'll be able to ask things like, what's the most efficient way for me to organize my staff according to what information I have in here, right? So that AI will be able to help. It'll be an aid. It won't take over. It won't just, it won't do everything, but it will be an aid to help management make better decisions. And I think that that's how we're seeing it. There's reporting AI as well, the ability to bring up reports that say, this should be relevant to you, this type of information. So it doesn't have to be so scary and it can definitely integrate with what we're doing. So that's what we're excited about.
Oh, wow. I really love that because I think today anybody who hasn't been using any of these capabilities, they are just kind of missing out in terms of what we can do as humans is now is a new thing, like a new skill, how to learn to integrate it, like think about things you can take advantage of and things like that. So it was really exciting. I love that. But in terms of your like team, so you said that you're building a lot of things. Do you have all your programmers in-house or do you work with outsourcing?
Yeah. So we do most of our team, it's kind of merged in the years, it's changed and we've tried different methods. And luckily, like I said, one of the owners is a developer. So he kind of took the brunt of all the work initially. And then eventually he's from Poland. So we had a team in Poland that worked on the people that he knew. And we still have a small portion of that. But now we've hired here in North America. So we've got developers in-house and they have very specific things that they're working on. And we've gotten really good at managing a development team. We didn't know anything at the beginning, but now we do. And so we get the most efficiency and we want them close. We want them to interact with our other staff so that they're getting feedback and they're getting information based on our customers and things that they should, hear about on a regular basis. So they participate in our team meetings and they're all part of the discussions that happen on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's really great. So I think we've spent a lot of time talking about ins and outs of a software company. And for a last question, I would love to know about how do you do marketing and sales? Do you have a sales team? Do you rely on online a lot, or do you still go to like meet people and find out contacts and do more old way? Like I think B2B is so diverse that you could do so many things.
We've gone through so many different scenarios based on the decades that we've been around, right? So, but right now the core of what we're doing is inbound marketing. So we have a good marketing team. We actually do some outsourcing of our marketing team and we have some in team staff. And so we do inbound, which is nurturing leads out in the world. They find us online. They read all the stuff and watch the videos that we do. And then eventually they want to download, a demo and kind of work with us. So that's typically the way we sell. Now, we don't have a sales team. So all we have is product specialists. And product specialists are there to showcase the product. You don't get a sales pitch with us. You get the product and you get a list of the benefits. And this is what we have. And we have no long-term contracts. So there's no benefit in us pushing you into something. It has to work for you. So that's why we only have product specialists. And those product specialists are trained on the product and they show the product. Once the person that's finding us somewhere online has come to us with that. And we get a constant flow of that. We're able to build our inbound leads through SEO and through, optimizing our content and doing production videos and podcasts and whatever it is. And people find us and then they from there, show interest in our product. So that's been our marketing these days.
Yeah. I think it's the most cost effective, right?
Like, yes.
You just do a good targeting and you do that. And in terms of outsourcing, do you work with any different countries or you're talking about just an agency?
Yeah, so we work with an agency out of the US and it's a great company and it's a company called Kuno Creative, K-U-N-O. And we work with them and they do a really good job at building our brand, working with us on, optimizing Google searches and tons of other things like video production and so on. So whether you do that internally or you outsource it, whatever the case is, that benefit of having a presence online and really consistent, valuable information to provide to people is what's going to draw people to your company. So that's where we found a value in that.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thank you, Dan, so much for sharing your journey. You guys have been successful, very smart in executing. So I've really loved hearing all the different ways how you grew. And thank you for inspiring entrepreneurs going into a different field. Like, don't feel that you need to know everything about the industry before going in. So you can be completely successful doing innovative stuff. And definitely best of luck to you and more innovative projects that you're making and the products that you would like to bring into the world. Thank you for your time again.
Thank you very much. It was nice talking to you.